James Greiner. He wrote a book about Don Sheldon, who was also with us tonight. Jim, by the way, is the curator of exhibits at the University of Alaska Museum here in Fairbanks. And, of course, Don Sheldon, glacier and rescue pilot with headquarters in Talkeetna. Jim, I'm going to turn it over to you for a minute. Why did you write the book?
Well, that's a big, broad question. We wrote the book simply because of Don's story. His career is most notable and very exciting, and it's a natural for a book of this kind. And so the book just sort of, in a way, almost wrote itself. I had thought about a book for a number of years, since very shortly after meeting Don, and I never, however, at that time, assumed that I would be writing it. And because I had never written a book before, I had written magazine articles, but I did not consider myself a writer, and I still don't, as a matter of fact. But nonetheless, the subject of the book came up, and Don and I decided to do it. It, I must say, was a mutual venture, because not only Don and I, but Don's wife and many, many other people were involved in this book. I really cannot take credit for the whole book. Dr. Bradford Washburn of the Boston Museum of Science, Cambridge, Massachusetts, had an integral part in the book. He checked my facts and did a lot of suggesting when it came to book content. He also, and most important, I think, provided a group of excellent pictures for the book, many of them never before published, pictures that date back to the original survey of the Alaska Range at Mount McKinley, and some very startling pictures. There are 30-some faces of pictures in the book, and all of them are excellent. And so the book was a joint venture. And as I said before, Don's career is one that lends itself 100% to a book of this kind. It's high adventure, and it's all true.
I see quite a few of the pictures in here include pictures of Don at long distance, and some of them bearded and frosted, as I've seen them many, many times. But a lot of the long shots here, were they who were they taken by? It doesn't necessarily give credit to in the cases of all of them. Are there any specific people involved in the picture taking? This one here, I'm picking up on page whatever it is. I'll figure that out in a minute.
Yes, the pictures, the long distance pictures, many of them anyway, were provided by the Anchorage Times. Mr. Bill Tobin of the Anchorage Times was gracious enough to spend many hours actually searching through their photo files down there for us. Don and I went to Anchorage toward the end of the writing of the book and poured through their tremendous files of photos. The one that you were looking at referred to the Day Bating rescue. Helga Bating and John Day, they were of separate parties, climbing parties, but it occurred in 1960, and the rescue camp was a massive area of confusion that Don can tell you much more about than I can, because he was there. But it was a tremendous rescue, probably one of the most complex rescues that's ever occurred on McKinley. Everything taken into account, the number of people and the number of aircraft that were involved and the total amount of time and efforts. It was a massive effort.
Why don't we just take the opportunity here. Don, why don't you explain this particular one? It's on page 196, by the way, of the book. And it says the rescue camp at 10,200 feet of the Kalhitna Glacier, I hope I pronounced that correctly, activities centered here in the rescue of Helga Bating and John Day team. Why don't you go ahead and explain just what happened and what caused all the problem getting in and out?
Well, weather is always a factor in some of the mountain disasters and some of the flying problems. In this particular case, the John Day expedition, including a party of four, Pete Schoening, an engineer from Seattle, and the Whitaker brothers, also of Seattle, expert professional mountaineers, were making a climb of the West Approach. Now, John Day had been a tremendous athlete in his youth, and at a later age had decided that he would climbed the peaks of all the major continents in record time. Now, this west approach climb started from the 10,200-foot elevation, Kahiltna Glacier, west approach of McKinley, and it was under the auspices of a special permit. Now, the special permit from McKinley National Park headquarters requires that you be photographic mapping or a geological or a scientific expedition to land that high on McKinley. The other straight climbing expeditions land at the park line, which is approximately the 7,000-foot level on the various glaciers. At any rate, the climb proceeded, and the John Day party were quite noticeable as they made 1,000 feet an hour under their heavy packs and proceeded nonstop to the peak of McKinley. That climb was successful one way. They took pictures, shook hands. They were so exhausted, and also the effects of high altitude had taken the toll. They shook hands, waltzed around in a circle, and fell off the west approach for about 1,000 feet. Luckily, they landed in a 70-foot powder snowdrift at the very base of the fall below Denali Pass. Fortunately, for the fall was stopped by this 70-foot snow cushion. However, they sustained fractures and concussions and were badly scrambled at the 17,200-foot level. At this particular moment, we got a radio message, not from this party, but from the Helga Baiting Expedition, who was on a different climb, on the same approach, however. A member of the team was Dr. Rodman Wilson, and he related that one member, Helga Baiting, had the dread affliction called cerebral edema. This is extremely serious and most oftentimes fatal. Strange things happen at high altitude to the physiology of the system. In this particular case, it is nine-tenths fatal. However, our intent was to immediately render assistance if possible. And the weather at this time was layered to 25,000, 30,000 feet. I was able to make an airdrop, not to the Helga Baiting Expedition, but to the John Day Expedition, which I found through the various layers of clouds, climbing as it was from the north approaches of McKinley over the Wickersham Wall to 21,000 feet, then on down to the 17,400-foot level, where I was lucky and made precision medical plasma, fuel, and various supply airdrops, a solo and a Super Cub. At this time, I did note the progress of the Helga Baiting Expedition coming down the west approach, the west buttress, which is 17,400 feet high, and they were relaying and belaying her down this very steep sheer ice. Okay, so I also looked this area over for possible landing sites. At 14,300 feet, I had located a site. I had conferred with Dr. Washburn, with whom I flew for 9 years to map the survey of the whole Alaska Range, and we agreed there would be but one place where you might land a fixed-wing aircraft. At the 14,300-foot level, there was a vertical sheer 5,000-foot wall on the end of a 1,700-foot run. The pitch was 30% steep. At the lower end of the pitch was a tremendous crevasse that you could drop the Nordale Hotel into. My problem was, if I landed, could I take off? 2 days later, I made a successful landing at that particular moment. Now, this is 2 days from the time we got the initial call for help via a handheld radio, which worked through Anchorage Communications. And I did make the landing. I did make the pickup. And then we called in a helicopter for the 17,400-foot elevation to relay down the John Day party, who were badly mauled in the fall of Denali Pass. Also, another aircraft flown by Stevenson, a contractor of Anchorage, and a professional mountaineer and member of Cold Weather Test, Elliot, crashed and burned while trying to make a subsequent airdrop at the 17,400-foot elevation. There are many aspects of which we do not have time to relate, but this was one of those Chinese fire drills that keep you on the edge of your seat. I might say that since 1960, May 18th, I have made probably 75 landings for Institute of Arctic Biology using 14,300-foot elevation as a base landing camp, also for rescues such as the Michiko Sakita Fall, where the Japanese crew fell for 4,000 feet to the 15,300-foot level, exactly 1,000 feet above my landing area, and for many other of the rescues since 1960.
Don, I've got a question that, and it's not meant to be embarrassing, but have you ever, in your going out to rescue other people, have you ever found yourself in a position where you had to stay overnight or have to get help from someone else?
I have. However, I did not damage any aircraft. I've been weatherbound. I have, in the last 25 years, spent 3 nights on McKinley weatherbound. So this would show you one thing. I try to be hard to catch in the weather systems. I hauled this summer, in a 5.5-month period of time, 300 skiers and mountaineers. You must choose your weather. The weather is extremely changeable. And you must negotiate whiteouts and sudden snow squalls and different cloud formations and freezing rime ice if you are to tie in and successfully ballistic haul all these people and all their freight in continuity without hanging up the rest of the crew in Talkeetna for a week while the weather clears.
One thing that you mentioned, that newcomers to Alaska probably say whiteout. What is that? I know what it is, and you know what it is. I've been caught in them. I know you have. Would you explain to our listeners what a whiteout is?
Well, a whiteout is a phenomenon where you lose reference of your usual ground references. This is critical in the mountains because you're hemmed in by tremendous jagged spires of ragged rock and ice and deep canyons. And you must bear in mind that this proposition of not being able to see because of moisture, either there's several types of whiteouts, I might say. For instance, let's take up on the Colville River. You can sometimes, well below zero, get into a condition, I say well below Fahrenheit freezing or centigrade freezing, I run into a condition of water particles in high-pressure air cells. Now, this will freeze on the airplane at 20 below, 30 below zero Fahrenheit. Also, this is non-conductive to visibility. This hangs in the atmosphere. It can either be small, fine particles of water in a high-pressure cell that should have been froze but isn't, or it can be extremely fine particles of frost, or it can be a combination of frost and various particles of snow that obscure visibility. The same applies to the altitudes of the high mountainous region of the Alaska Range.
Does this have any effect on radio reception or transmission at all?
Well, precipitation static is probably what you're talking about. And I'm sure that all water in the atmosphere has a certain amount of precipitation static. Snow has slightly less.
Jim, we didn't mean to ignoring you here. Why don't I just turn this over to you for a couple of minutes? I'm sure that you've got some questions that you asked Don when you were getting ready to write the book that our listeners might be interested in hearing.
Well, of course, the question that I had uppermost in my mind is the one that everybody asks Don, and that is, what was his hairiest landing? I asked him that early on, and I found out after talking with him for actually a relatively very short time, I found out that there were lots and lots of hairy landings, and no single one, I suppose, stands out any more than others. But that was one of the things that I, of course, was interested in. And before I even began to get into Don's story, I realized that there were many, many hairy landings. One thing I thought I'd mention here, and Don was telling about the Helga Bating rescue, he mentioned that she was suffering from cerebral edema. And this is a term that I heard about, of course, early on when we were beginning to write the book. And I didn't know any more about it, I don't think, than the average person does. It was called altitude sickness. There's another kind of edema, which is called pulmonary edema, which was called altitude pneumonia. Nobody really knew what caused it. And Dr. Rodman Wilson, who was one of the members of the Helga Bating climbing team, treated Helga Bating as best he could with materials that Don airdropped to them. And after he came down off of McKinley and everything turned out fine, Helga Bating was successfully rescued by Don. Being a doctor, a very capable doctor, I might add, he researched the malady and he described it in a medical journal. And that was the first time in the autumn of 1960 that the syndrome of edema was described. And it's very simply, at least the way I understand it, a buildup of lymph tissue, lymph fluid, either in the lungs or in the skull, and it causes some terrible symptoms, many very often death, and it plagues the mountain climbers, and it doesn't seem to be related to a person's condition particularly. There can be amateur climbers who go to the top of various mountains and never are bothered by edema. Sometimes professional climbers who are in top condition and excellent athletes by anyone's standards will get this edema or the symptoms of it. And so it's a strange disease, and it's typical high altitude type condition that comes along. I'm not an expert on edema, but I thought that it might be worth saying a few things about it, because it occurs through the book. Many of the people that are described in the book and the incidents relate to edema.
Before we started to talk about this particular part of the program, the rescue, Jim, you mentioned that Don had also picked up stragglers, if you will, along the highway, rescued people along the highway by landing on a certain portion of the highway to pick up someone who may have been, their car may have gone fluey or someone was injured or something like that. Now, you work in conjunction with the state troopers doing something like that to what they call you in and say, hey, we got somebody stuck at mile whatever and we'd like to get them out. Would you please come in and get them?
You bet. We hopefully are available on a 24-hour basis. And there are many construction camps, mining camps, hunting camps, and we maintain HF radio contact with any of these portable HF sets throughout the area. And as a matter of fact, we talk to people throughout Alaska, and we all endeavor to lend assistance when at all possible. The construction camps are a fair source of problems and possible hospital cases, the mountaineering accidents, since it has accelerated to its present state, are becoming more frequent, and there's more people in the area, and therefore there's a greater need. So we use the resource that we have, our fine airplanes, equipped with floats, skis, wheels, cross-country gear, sandbar gear, and whatever is necessary to try to expedite and to get the injured, if possible, in the shortest length of time to hospital aid.
Don, I think something that came to my mind is, as I'm listening to you talk about your general rescue on the rescues and your work on the highway, was the troublesome creek incident that is described in the book. And that's a perfect example of what can happen. And I think that would be an interesting thing to talk about, the D9 Cat.
Well, on the original construction of the Fairbanks-Anchorage Highway, there were five construction camps originally. Morrison, Knutson, and other major construction companies were in the process of building this beautiful Anchorage-Fairbanks Highway. And on this particular case, I had one member of a German expedition, and we were en route. He was 3 days late for his expedition into the Alaska Range area. And I met this German doctor as an old train pulled into Talkeetna. And he was easy to identify. He was 6'6". He had a handlebar mustache with an 8-inch wingspan and a monocle flash from his right eye. He had a great saber mark on his left cheek. And I rushed forward and told the great member, the doctor of the German expedition, I said, you are very welcome to Talkeetna, and I have a plane ready to take you immediately to your expedition site, Dr. Von Wetzel. And he says, hi, Dr. Von Wetzel. We go. Well, go we did. And we got about 60 miles northwest of Talkeetna and out to his expedition camp. He was complete with his two big medical satchels and his other gear. And we were monitoring 3411, the emergency frequency, when a very harassed and excited voice sounded from identification, Troublesome Creek. Very fitting location, said, we have just run over one of our cat skinners with a D9 Caterpillar. Will anybody in the area lend assistance? And I say to the great Dr. Von Wetzel, Dr. Von Wetzel, would you care to lend assistance to this man who has just been crushed by a D9 Caterpillar? And he looks startled and he says, Ja, we fix him up. So we proceeded post haste, landed on a sandbar, tore off across the water up to our shoe buckles and up to our chins, and we got over in 300 yards to where the site of the accident was. And sure enough, this one cat skinner driving one D9 Cat had seen a brand new chainsaw. He had stopped his in front of his path. He leaped off his D9 Caterpillar, went to pick up the chainsaw. A second D9 just wiped him out and kept right on going. Anyway, he was crushed from his shoe buckles to his belt and in excruciating pain and still conscious. And Dr. Von Wetzel went right to work. He splinted him fore and aft. And I had a sudden revelation that I would never get the tremendous splints inside my Cessna aircraft. I had landed on a short sandbar. There was no way to get a man with broken legs and broken pelvis into my Cessna. So I got on my powerful HF radio. I called our home base at Talkeetna. They in turn relayed a call to a helicopter in the area. Within 30 minutes, the man was airbound via the helicopter basket to Talkeetna. We had our larger aircraft, CAP Beaver, in Talkeetna, and within 3 hours, 45 minutes from the time of the accident, Orville Engelhorn, the unlucky cat skinner of the big diesel Caterpillar, was on the operating table. And 6 months later, on another emergency run into Anchorage, I was, at that time, I had a car in Anchorage, and I would, in order to expedite the movement of these emergency cases, I would wheel them into my car and blast off in my old car for the hospital, and this saved maybe a few minutes sometimes. So I had completed another case. Now, this is 6 months later, and I couldn't believe my eyes, staggering down the hall on a walker with a cane and barely making his way, was the victim of the accident of the 6 months previous. Orville Engelhorn was his name. And I said, "Orville, you're up, you're around, you're walking." He says, "Man, yeah." I say, "What was the worst part of that whole ordeal? As the cat drove over you, crushed you from your shoe buckles to your belt, you were in excruciating pain. Tell me, what was the worst part of the whole ordeal?" And he says, "Boy," he says, "the worst part of that whole ordeal was when the cook come tearing out of the cook shack with a fifth of scotch, and he poured it down my throat, and I hate scotch."
Well, that just sort of points up the human end of the whole thing. Well, there's one. How many others can you count them whose lives may have been saved by your quick work?
Well, I didn't keep close count, but I've been pretty well involved since 48. And since we've always had a good fleet of airplanes and happily been available, we've filled the Anchorage hospitals a time or two full of accident victims.
Jim, I wonder if you could, just getting away for a few minutes, because we are just about to run out of time here, could you describe your book, the book's success, and the name of your book, Wager with the Wind. Will you explain the success of it, please?
Well, to start out, it's been phenomenal. Beyond our wildest imagination, the book has apparently just literally taken off, especially down below, and of course in Alaska, where I just knew people would be interested in it. But the publishing company, our publishing company, Rand McNally, published 11,000 copies of the book in the first printing. And in 2.5 weeks' time, they were gone from their Chicago office. And it caught Rand McNally flat-footed. It's a record for the publishing company, which is saying something, because they've been in the business for many, many years. They are now really tearing their hair and getting ready to come up with a much, much larger second printing. And I hope we won't see any kind of a lag between the availability of books. But the book has been a really tremendous success, and I think the thing that really makes it all worthwhile for me is that there are so many people in so many places interested in the story. And this really makes it worth all of the effort.
Well, I certainly want to thank both of you for joining us tonight. We've been speaking with Jim Greiner, who is the author of Wager with the Wind. That's about, you guessed it, Don Sheldon, glacier and rescue pilot. Two very, very interesting gentlemen to have with us here on Inside 74. This has been a public affairs program of Big Country Radio. This is Larry Stevens in Fairbanks. Good evening.